Recording. See, I got to say it this time. Welcome to the Grumpy Dungeon Masters podcast, where we don't talk about Elder Brain Tarrasque. I'm one of the hosts, Jay. My co-host is...
You could say my name.
I could, but it's more fun listening to you stumble on remembering what it is.
My name is the podcast boy. The boy who has podcast topics.
Ah, yes, for the first time in 3 weeks, which is good, because I actually don't have a whole lot this week, so.
No longer am I Christopher McNotopics. I am the podcast boy, the boy with podcast topics.
Been a relatively busy week, at least within role-playing game news, but I'm sure we'll cover a couple of things.
A couple things happened, some things of note. You know, I actually have one note where I should write down podcast topics and stuff.
What? All right.
It even comes with links and shit. I'm trying to be organized now.
Wow.
So let me tell you a quick story. Christopher McNotopics was a young man with a passion for storytelling, but he always felt a little out of place. He had tried his hand at writing short stories and even a few failed attempts at a novel, but nothing seemed to stick. One day, while scrolling through social media, Christopher stumbled upon a podcast that caught his attention. He was intrigued by the way the host was able to captivate the audience with their words, weaving together narratives and sharing insights in an engaging way. Christopher realized that this could be his chance to finally share the stories he had bottled up inside. Filled with a newfound inspiration, Christopher decided to start his own podcast. He spent weeks planning out the format, brainstorming potential guests and topics, and perfecting his recording setup. Finally, the day came to record his first episode, and nervously he pressed the record button and began to speak. To his surprise, the words flowed naturally, and he found himself lost in the conversation. Listeners began to tune in, drawn in by Christopher's warm and relatable personality. He started to receive messages from people who felt connected to the stories he was sharing, and it fueled his passion even further. Before long, Christopher was amazed by a loyal following, and he became known in his community as the Podcast Boy. He reveled in the opportunity to give a voice to untold stories and to create a space for meaningful dialogue. Through his podcast, Christopher was able to connect with people from all walks of life, sharing their experiences and perspectives in a way that his both informative and emotionally resonant stories gave him. He had finally found his calling, and he was determined to continue sharing his power of storytelling to the world. That's the worst superhero character ever.
Yeah. So first off, congratulations on reading all of that and not flubbing really anything. So,
oh, yeah, yay for me.
Secondly, which AI wrote that?
Claude the Tiefling.
Of course.
Sitting there. Yeah.
Of course, yes. It read like an AI wrote it.
Oh, yeah.
And I knew damn well you didn't write it, so.
No. Actually, the first thing I have to talk about is something Magic the Gathering related. And I know we're not a Magic the Gathering podcast, but this is too interesting for me not to bring up.
It's all sort of tied together.
Have you ever heard of the Magic the Gathering format called the Forgetful Fish?
I have not, and I've played a lot of Magic formats, but that's a new one on me.
So the Forgetful Fish is a Magic the Gathering deck that's built, and the purpose of it is it features the creature card Dandan. Do you know Dandan?
Two blue, 4/1. Pretty sure he's island bound. You have to have, I don't remember the proper term. Island home, yeah.
You have to have islands, and your opponents have to have islands for him to do anything. Well, this is a little different. So it's one deck, all right? And that one deck and its graveyard is all shared by both opponents, okay? So you draw from the same deck, you play the same cards from that deck, and it's all blue. And there's a lot of, like, recursion effects that kind of puts the graveyard back into the deck. And there are 10 Dandan cards in the deck.
Okay.
So Dandan's the only creature, and you basically, when you attack with Dandan, you lose one hit point Okay, and basically you have 5 hit points total. So when Danon hits you 5 times, you die. So I found this, and it just made me think, like, it's crazy out there that there are some games that have an infinite amount of different formats and things you can do with their mechanics that just let you kind of go crazy with it. And this Dandan deck is pretty much the great example of that. How, like, you don't have to play Magic, you don't need $1,000 in cards, just this $80 deck, and you play against each other, and that's it.
And honestly, because you just explained the entire format, you could literally build it out of fucking commons if you wanted.
Oh yeah.
Like, Dandan is an older out of print card, but he was massively, massively printed during Chronicles, and he's probably been reprinted a couple times since then. So even buying Dandan online is probably 15 cents.
He's $1.79.
Okay. Well, he's a little I've got a stack of that fucker sitting in a junk box. So, but yeah.
It's quite interesting. Like, it's just a lot of, like, you know, tapping the creature, bouncing the creature, and, like, just cycling people's cards and whatnot to get more Dandans on your side so you can swing with them and stuff.
Yeah. You could even do that multiplayer. Like, a 4-person could easily do that.
So, I've been kind of exploring a lot of different game systems recently because I haven't had much time to do anything else.
By the way, real quick, because my one topic I had for tonight, I actually wanted to talk about what games people played during the medieval times. So, oddly enough, we're actually almost on the same page.
Well, yours are probably more interesting because I was going to talk about how I had a big project I've been working on for a while, and it was to celebrate the 5th anniversary of my local gaming store, Zenergy Gamers, here in Charleston, South Carolina. I basically made a bunch of Magic card proxies out of different Magic cards, put them into little self-made decks, and put it inside of a box that I made, and sealed it with actual Magic the Gathering wrapping, so it looked like it was a legitimate box, and gave it to the store owner. And it was a big hit. All the employees got a pack, and they were all trading it, and they're still trading the cards now. It was a really great gift. And as a return gift, because I can't seem to leave the store, he doesn't let me, he wouldn't let me leave until he gave me something for that gift. And he gave me a bag of older D&D modules that they had required from somebody who didn't want them. And I started going through
some of those are probably valuable, just saying.
I looked at them and I was like, I know these are worth a lot. You shouldn't just give them to me. You should make me pay for them. And he's like, oh, absolutely not. So I was like, I love you. And I got no more than 3 deep before I was like, okay, I know what I need to talk about. So first off is the first book I pulled out. Actually, this is the last book I pulled out, but it's the first one I want to talk about. I have in my hands the collector's edition for Fallout New Vegas Game Guide. Okay.
Okay.
It's a limited edition book, and it has limited edition number printed on it. It was published in 2010 by Prima Games. And okay. I was like, holy cow, this is amazing. So I started flipping through the book. All right. And
oh yeah, wait. Prima. Yeah, they do video game guides.
Hold on. Don't get ahead of me, fucker.
I'm just saying they do video game.
You're getting ahead of me, fucker. All right.
You already said it, but go ahead.
Hold on. So I'm looking through it and I'm like, there's layouts, monster stats, like different pictures, in-game pictures and whatnot. I was like, oh my god, this is the best tabletop role-playing system book I've ever seen in my entire life. So I'm going through it, and I get to chapter 1, and I'm like reading it like as if I'm reading like how to play this game on a tabletop.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, dear god, this is the most complicated gaming system I've ever seen of. Like, why would they have bullets minus your damage percentage by 0.029%? How are you going to calculate that on paper? That only work as a video game. And I got through the first chapter, and I was just like, oh my god, I need to see what the character sheet looks like. So I went to the table of contents to find what the character sheet looked like. And I went through the table of contents, I was like, there's no character sheet of this. And then I looked back at the front cover again, and it wasn't just game guide, it's the official game guide. And then I looked at it, and it looked at me, and I looked at it, and it looked at me, and I was like, oh, this is a game guide for the video game.
Yeah. That makes more sense. It is. There it is. Sorry, I threw that out there. When you started talking about it, my initial response was, oh, okay, he knows it's a video game guide, and he's looking at it from the lens of a role-playing game. I didn't realize you weren't aware that Prima makes video game guides.
I know they make video game guides. I remember that now.
Yeah.
But like,
I have the Baldur's Gate 2 Prima video game guide literally sitting across the room from me that I just picked up a couple days ago.
But this book is set up like it's, all right, here's this next chapter. Here's the modules you got to go through. Here are the missions. Here are the monsters you use. It's set up like it's a tabletop game.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just
it's
like,
it's got the map layouts and all that fun stuff, which is freaking awesome, by the way.
Yeah.
Because you could utilize components from that for role-playing games easily.
I actually had a friend that did that. Like, one of my first tabletop experiences was when I was in college, and I think we were playing 3.5 or something. I don't know. I really just had dice. I didn't even have a character sheet. And the person who was DMing for us was using Parasite Eve, the player's guide for that, because it had all the maps laid out in that.
By the way, if you ever see that guide, pick it up. It's worth good money.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. But I was actually quite disappointed because I thought this was a tabletop game. And yeah. Like, I've been talking to my wife about getting the Fallout one from Modiphius.
Yeah, Modiphius. Yeah.
And it just seems so serendipitous that this popped out once the Fallout show got out there and people watched that. And
it was great.
Fantastic. That was the first book I wanted to talk about. My misunderstanding of what that actually was.
Yes. Yes, you definitely pulled a Christopher Waples on that one.
Yeah. The second one is a book that I started looking at. I was like, okay, let's talk about this one. I think it's White Wolf. Yeah,
okay.
It is White Wolf. It's a tribe book called Silver Fangs.
Yeah, I guess I own that book.
You own that book. Okay.
Yes.
Because holy shit, is this a book I would never read. like I know that when you play Warhammer and you buy a chapter book, like, you get a chapter book, like, you're now enlisted in this chapter for life. Here's all of our lore, what we're eating for breakfast tomorrow, our likes and dislikes. And I think that's what this book is, because, oh my god, it's like seven chapters of just like short story.
It's lore.
Lore and everything. And it's great in what it is. I don't want to knock it for that. It's great in what it is. But like, I could never sit here and try to create a character from this. Like,
as you are,
it needs a bit more streamlined for me. Maybe if I was playing the White Wolf game, this would speak more to me.
So first off, it's older, you know, and that was more the style back then. I can't speak for what the current versions of it are. Secondly, White Wolf was the storytelling game. And I say it very specifically as a storytelling game. It was a role-playing game. It had rules, but it focused way more in depth on the lore, the setting. Your characters were supposed to be very, very in depth on their backgrounds. So every werewolf character, every vampire character, every mage character, you had a story, a history, and that's what that book is much more focused on. If you go through it, there's probably some things in there that it gives you abilities that Silver Fangs could use and things like that, but the vast majority of it is just going to be, this is what the Silver Fangs are. This is how many hundreds of years that clan has been around. These are the things they've lived through, etc.
So the table of contents starts at page 13. Which is odd, but
it's a short story before it. So
there's a short story before it called "Heavy Lies the Crown: The Legends of Garu," And then chapter one is Under Falcon's Wings, History. And before I actually go further, I wanted to see what character creation was. So I went to the table of contents and I saw where it said character creation and I flipped to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I flipped to it, to the character creation page, it said chapter three, Good Breeding. And yep. I was like,
that's Silver Fangs. Yeah, that's and Silver Fangs, man.
And I go back to the contents. It's chapter one, Under Falcon's Wings, History. Chapter two, Pleased to See the King, Society. Chapter three, Good Breeding, Character Creation. I was like, okay, I guess I'm in the right spot. Short story. Let's skip over that. Let's go into the backgrounds. So I'm looking at just the major titles. So backgrounds. Allies is the subcategory to backgrounds. I'm not reading any of the text. I'm just trying to figure out things by just the heading.
Yeah.
So backgrounds and then allies. Okay. Ancestors. Mm-hmm. Okay. Contacts. All right. Fetish. What?
a fetish is a... I know what it is, but yeah. Nope. All right. Yeah. Just it has a completely different context than what you're thinking of, or what your initial thought was.
Really? Because there happens to be a character sheet that came with this book that I cannot show off. But just let me say, it is well endowed.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not normally in the book.
Mm-hmm.
A fetish in werewolf or in white wolf in general, you have to think fetish as in almost voodoo witch doctor. It's basically an item that is enchanted, usually with some sort of a spirit.
Okay, so an actual fetish, not the sexual fetish.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, anyways, that's as far as I got with the book, and I set it down, and I was like, you know what? I know this is white wolf. I'm not going to read it.
Yeah. I mean, look, I honest to God don't know anyone who actually plays vampire werewolf anymore. I collect all the books for specifically vampire and werewolf. I never got into mage or wraith or any of the other offshoots. So I don't bother with those. And it's one of those things. If I knew people who really wanted to play or knew people who were going to run it, I'm in. But it's not really a thing that much anymore. Times have changed and people are much less edgy, and I say that with quotation marks because that's what that setting was.
Yeah. So when I was initially going through this bag in the store, I pulled out three things and I was like, oh, that's really cool. Oh, that's really, really cool. Okay. This has to be the coolest thing in the bag. And that's the first thing I'm going to talk about. The last thing I'm going to talk about this stack today in this podcast.
You're going to save all the other stuff and just do like three every podcast until you've talked about all of them?
Kind of, yeah.
I like this plan. Let's do it.
So the third thing I pulled out was Dungeon Module B2.
Okay.
The Keep on the Borderlands by Gary Gygax.
Yeah. I don't own a copy of that one, but I'm vaguely familiar
with it. A complete copy of it. So which
I would assume first edition. Is it the red cover?
It is.
Or the blue cover with the orange?
It is red cover.
Okay, yeah.
It's for the Dungeons & Dragons basic set, but can be used with advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
Okay, yeah.
So it has the fold-out map. It has also included the cleric reference table, I guess from some other book, because it says here that this is a reference table and the pages are perforated for easy removal. So I'm sure he took this out of a different book.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a second ed book or something like that.
No, it could have come from basic. Okay. Second edition wouldn't have been out for 9 years at least.
Okay. Then I have a piece of scrap paper. Okay. That has all the loot that they have been getting so far, I guess.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
They have 21,000 gold pieces, 75,000 silver pieces, 10,000 electrum pieces, 97 gems, 6,000 copper, 20 nice jewels, 2,800 PP.
That's platinum point or platinum pieces, but
8 plus 1 arrows, a rope of climbing, 40,000 gope. I don't know what that is.
Gold area.
No, because gold's up there before.
Yeah,
three potions. One is blue dragon control. Two is sweet water. Three is water breathing. Scrolls. One was used because it was crossed out. And that was raised dead. Okay. Then he has stone to flesh, and then animate dead, pass wall of stone. And then he has four spell books, and it's got some more stuff on it. It was just a piece of scrap paper, you know, that he's keeping notes on. Then I have the guy's character. Okay. Oh. He was a cleric, race human, and has all his abilities and stuff like that, all of his tools, all of his stats and whatnot. It's an amazing thing to look at. Really cool. And so that came together. And like I said, of the module itself, I have the map, which is a single piece of paper, which gets lost easily. And then I got the module itself, and I got the cover, which has the actual Caves of Chaos in there.
Yeah.
And I took a couple pictures of a couple things that I'm going to put on our Discord, and I'll talk about them.
Make sure to share that character sheet.
I'll share the character sheet too, yeah. So the module itself begins, Dungeon Module B2, The Keep on the Borderlands. This is an introductory module for characters 1 through 3. And on the front cover, you have like two human fighters, axe and shield, sword and board, and what looks to be like a halfling with a spear. And they're fighting the old school bugbear. The old school owlbear. Like the beak and like the brown fur and everything.
Okay, we're looking at different covers than...
No. This is the actual one inside the booklet, not the.
Okay. The front page. I see it right there. Yeah.
So it's got an old school bugbear, and they're coming out again here with the 50th anniversary minis. It's my favorite bugbear. I actually have a couple, because it actually looks like a giant fucking monstrosity and not just a giant owl. You know.
Yeah.
I don't mind the giant owl. Don't get me wrong. But I like this thing better because this thing looks like it's going to eat the shit out of you.
The current owlbear is fucking cute and cuddly, and people make plushies of it. This one, you're not making a plushie out of this fucker. This is something from your nightmares.
Yeah,
like, it is horrific. It would eat you asshole first.
So, I spent some time reading this module because this is something that I really wanted to get in good with. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to read a couple select things here real quick. This is, again, written by Gary Gygax. So these are the notes for the Dungeon Master section. Okay. This will be a little long, so I apologize in advance. The basic instruction book for Dungeons & Dragons has given you the information necessary to understand D&D and start play. This module is another tool. It is a scenario which will help you to understand the fine art of being a dungeon master as you introduce your group of players to your own fantasy world. Your interpretation of the many worlds of Dungeons & Dragons, The Keep on the Borderlands, is simply offered as a vehicle for your use, a way to move smoothly and rapidly into your own special D&D campaign. Read the module thoroughly. You will notice that the details are left in your hands. This allows you to personalize the scenario and suit it to what you and your players will find most enjoyable. Now, that's definitely a lost thing in the current world of module creation. I think on DM's Guild, you'll find a couple of those where people just write this as a generic scenario. I'm working on one now. It's just like that. You know, it's just, here's a town. Here are the people in the town. And here's the scenario with the town. Everything else is left up to you.
Mm-hmm.
With a couple things that I have written, like the Owl campaign that I'm writing right now, it's like I had to figure out a way to like stick it into the lore and have it work. It was same with the Christmas module and my Icewind Dale thing, you know, and that was easy. And it's nice to kind of like, you know, use that as a little aside as to what's happening. But overall, it's just very odd. So, just continuing on, this module has been designed to allow 6 to 9 player characters of first level. What?
Yeah.
Is he smoking crack?
Well, no, most of them are going to be dead after the first or second encounter.
Six to nine players. How are you getting six to nine people to sit down? How are you scheduling this? Where's the math on how to figure out where exactly you're getting six to nine fully grown adults with responsibilities and
children to show up and
play Dungeons and Dragons at the same time?
No, I can't tell you how many games I've sat in with six to nine players. My normal group is six players. I do have a hard cap of six. I don't play more than that anymore. But, you know, when I was a teenager and older than that shit, it was nothing for us to have nine people sitting around a table playing D&D. It was also second edition. Second edition is quick. Yeah, you're not spending 3 minutes per character per turn or 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
This module was released in 1980, so that's still first.
Yeah, well, this is basic. But yeah, it's same time period as first.
All right. Six to nine players are first level to play out many adventures, gradually working up to second or third level of experience in the process. And keep note of that. By the end of this whole thing, they want you to be second or third. Most likely second. Mm-hmm. Third's a possibility. The group is assumed to have at least one magic user and one cleric in it. I think that's fine. I mean, people always ask the question. Everybody likes a trifecta. A healer, a caster, and a tank. You know?
If you didn't have a cleric in basic or first edition or second, you had a serious fucking problem.
Yeah.
Like, you needed healers.
If you have fewer than six players, be sure to arrange for them to get both advice and help in the keep. For example, they should have advice from a friendly individual who says stay near the beginning of the ravine area and enter the lower caves first to help avoid them getting into immediate trouble with higher level monsters. Likewise, the service of several men of arms must be available to smaller parties. If only one or two player characters are to adventure, be sure to have a non-player character or two go along, as well as a few men-at-arms. In addition, give the player characters a magic dagger or some magic arrows and at least one potion of healing. Six to nine players. Give them one potion of healing.
Going to heal you like 1d8 or some shit.
I mean, in my adventure league games, these players are like, okay, we have how much gold right now? All right, let's everyone buy six potions of healing. All right. that's definitely an ideal that's changed since 1980.
Yeah.
The DM should be careful to give the player characters a reasonable chance for survival. Aw, man. If your players tend to be a bit rash and unthinking, it might be better to allow them to have a few men-at-arms along, even if the party is large, and they actually don't attempt to hire... If the party's large, comma, and they actually don't attempt to hire such mercenaries, period. I don't know. Hopefully they will quickly learn that the monsters here will act together and attack with reasonable intelligence, if applicable. If this lesson is not learned, all that can be done is allow the chips to fall as they may. Dead characters cannot be brought back to life here.
Yep.
And it goes on and explains a little bit about the keep, and essentially about how the keep is a microcosm of adventure as well, where there's a lot of people that you can interact with. There's on the map of the area on the back of it. It's a map of the keep. And you're supposed to basically spend your first level just bouncing around this city, talking to people, finding stuff, and helping them out within the keep itself. To not only establish your character party as being part of the keep, but also kind of like get an idea of what's out there, do some first research onto what's going on, and then eventually move on to the outside world. All right?
Yeah.
So, I generally don't think that works anymore for 5th edition with brand new players. They really want to just get into the combat as quickly as possible. I mean, groups are individual with that. But I do find that when I give my players an opportunity to kind of sit around town and do whatever they want And I give them, maybe it's just I always give them too big of a berth. Like, here's all of Waterdeep. Do what you want. And they're like, yeah,
they're not going to know if they're brand, if they're brand new, they're not going to understand the process of how to do things.
So this sets up the keep, and it's like 27 different locations in there. All with different kind of guards and scribes and spells and all a bunch of shit. It's really nice. Like, I really wish this would be updated for 5th edition. I'm kind of thinking of just doing it myself because, like, I think they would miss a lot of the nuance that was set up in that initial place for them to actually figure out what's going on.
Do they not have it on DM's Guild updated?
No. This has never been updated.
I figured somebody had already done it for WotC.
Maybe somebody has, but no one's officially done it for WotC. So then the next section of this keep on the borderlands is once you finally set out from the town, you're supposed to find the Caves of Chaos and destroy the monsters that are inside of it. All right. The map you're given has 4 encounters laid out on the map. Okay. And so when your players get within 6 squares of that encounter, you have a certain percentage chance of that encounter occurring. Okay.
Okay.
And they're pretty much set in all the cardinal directions. There's like 2 to the south and like 1 immediately north of the keep and another 1 east of the keep. There really is no west of the keep because the keep's on the west side of the map.
Yeah, yeah.
The Caves of Chaos are in the upper northeast.
So the players, they don't know where the Caves of Chaos are. They just have to wander.
Yeah. And there's a place in there where it's called Caves of the Unknown, which I'm pretty sure eventually becomes the Tomb of Horrors. But as of this module here, this is for you to do whatever you want with it. If you don't have anything planned for it, they can't find it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure that eventually becomes a Tomb of Horrors.
Could be.
So there are the 4 random encounters that happen, random, quote unquote. They're set. As long as you guys get close to them, they can happen. So there's 4 encounters. There's the Mound of the Lizardmen, the Spider's Lair, the Bandit Camp, and the Mad Hermit. Now, the Mad Hermit, honestly, it's all about the photo that goes with the Mad Hermit.
I've seen it, yeah.
It's this dude with the weirdest smile, with like belly hair that's so long it covers like his private areas, all right? And he's just a deranged looking motherfucker in a tree. It's just so weird. And I'll put it up in our podcast chat so you can take a look at it. But it is just so odd. But anyways, so the Mountain of the Lizardmen, I like how they set that up. It's a random encounter. Like, 6 lizardmen come out of the hole and they attack. And, you know, if you go into the hole, there's 1 person behind. There's also a bunch of female lizardmen there. And if you're not careful, then they'll all attack as once. And they have different stats for the males and the females and the children that are in there. And you can find just the different stuff that pops in there. The Spider's Lair is just a bunch of spiders that'll attack you. The interesting part about that is, it says that under a pile of leaves nearby is a skeleton of a victim, a hapless elf. Everything he bore has turned to rot and ruin, save a filthy shield, which appears quite worthless. But cleaning and oiling will return it to its +1 magical status.
Huh.
Ooh. I didn't know you could clean and oil a shield and have it return to be magical.
Well, apparently you could in basic Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, I guess so. Blaze, I'm reading D&D modules. I can't pet you right now. You're a good cat. Kitty. I love you.
Kitty requires pettings.
The bandit catch, just a bunch of bandits. Nothing really crazy there. The Mad Hermit. All right. Let me read this one. It says, for many years, a solitary hermit has haunted this area of the forest, becoming progressively wilder and crazier and more dangerous. His dwelling is a huge hollow trunk. The entrance to the trunk cavity is concealed by a thick bush. Inside is a mound of leaves and a couple pieces of crude furniture. Even his cup and plate are handmade of wood and are of no value. There's a small chest buried beneath a few inches of dirt under the leaves the Mad Hermit calls a bed. In this container are 31 gold pieces, 164 silver pieces, and a potion of invisibility and a plus one dagger. The hermit also has a pet, quote unquote, a puma which lurks in hiding on a limb of the oak. Ready to spring into action upon any unwary intruder, this creature always gets the first attack. So,
I love the fact that they have a chest that is buried that you will probably never find unless you know to look for it. A lot of early edition stuff was like that. Just random things that you could probably never find. I see it a lot in Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Yeah.
And I love that they are there. Because there's a chance, you know, it gives the game master the ability to say, you know, with your elven senses, you sense a slight mound of dirt or whatever. You could either just never have them find it, or if you want to give it out, somebody can find it, or you could have a percentage chance. Fifth edition, use perception, whatever.
Yeah. And so after that is the Caves of Chaos. And we've talked about on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, the Dungeon Professor and his the room in there where the orcs attack pull everybody and kills everybody. And so I don't want to bounce on that. I didn't want to read through the whole thing. I didn't have enough time. But I wanted to see what like the final encounter of the module was. So I went to like the last page where all the final encounters are.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately in the upper right corner of the book, I saw a monster that I immediately knew what it was, but I immediately became so infatuated with it, I believe it's my spirit animal. And it is, for lack of a better descriptive term, it's an obese sturge.
I saw it as soon as you posted it to us earlier, and my initial thought was, oh, that's just the sturge that lives at Chris's house. Like he's just feeding on you.
it's just so picture a sturge, you know, Google sturge. It's a giant mosquito, essentially. But this one, he's got like six chins, a big
he's got fat rolls.
And I'm just like, this thing, all it does is just go and fly around and just eat babies, man. This is on the final page of the module for being like where all the big scary end monsters are. And like, this is the final thing. This is the final image you're giving me. Not like what's involved here or like the scary things that are supposed to be here at the end. No, you're getting me the sturge with diabetes. Great.
See, there's still there's a misconception about these older modules. They didn't have BBEGs. They didn't have big, bad, evil guys. Sometimes they did, but a lot of them, it's not that case. It's just, here's an adventure. What, you know, there's not a big boss at the end of the module. It's just whatever the hell you fight along the way.
And I was about to bring that up, actually.
I figured you were, but I got to it before you.
So the big bad of this is really a curse. Okay. And I posted the module chapter in our podcast chat. I'm going to read it here too. And it's the Evil Chapel. All right. Number 55, there's 64 areas here. The other places aren't. There are monsters in there, but there's no, like you said, no real big bad. Okay. This is the Evil Chapel, and there's a chamber of the evil priest. There's some undead things in there. There's one thing we'll talk about here in a minute, but that's like an extra thing to the whole thing. But the evil chapel is kind of like the whole point of the Caves of Chaos. I'll go ahead and read it here. It says, this place is of red stone, the floor being a mosaic checkerboard of black and red. The south wall is covered by a huge tapestry which depicts a black landscape, barren trees, and an unidentifiable but horrible black shapes and silhouette. Possibly demons of some sort. Holding aloft a struggling human. A gray sky is torn by wisps of purple clouds, and a bloody moon with a skull-like face on it leers down upon the scene. Four black pillars support the dome ceiling some 25 feet overhead, Between these columns, just in front of the tapestry, is a stone altar of red-veined black rock, rough-hewn and stained brown with dried blood. Upon it are four ancient bronze vessels, a shallow bowl, a pair of goblets, and an ewer, and a vase-shaped pitcher. They are all also bloodstained, but obviously worth a great deal of money. The value is 1,000 GP for each cup, and 2,000 GP for each of the other items. But these are all relics of chaos, and any character possessing them will not part with them, or sell them, or allow others to handle them. For each character who picks up one of these objects, the DM should roll a secret saving throw versus magic at a -2. And first edition, -2 is really hard.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty big disadvantage there.
That's like a 20?
If you have an 18 in a stat, I think you have +3. Maybe you get a +4, but you don't start getting pluses until you have at least a 15 in something.
Yeah.
So a -2 is, that's the equivalent of having like a fucking 6 intelligence or you know, 6 wisdom, yeah, or some shit like that.
Yeah. Anyone who saves successfully will get a feeling of great evil about the object, and he or she may voluntarily put it down. If the save fails, the character will rapidly fall under the influence of a demonic spell, and within 6 days become a servant of chaos and evil, returning to this chapel to replace the relics, and then staying as a guard forever after. If someone attempts to destroy these relics, the Great Bell, C58, will sound, and the shrine's residents will come running in 3 rounds. And then a couple more things about how to detect the evil and how to dispel them and stuff like that.
Yep.
So essentially, the big bad is just these objects.
Yeah.
You touch them, you're now part of the objects.
Yeah.
Forever and ever.
There are a lot of nasty things like that in the earlier editions. You know,
yeah, I don't remember in any of the 5th edition module stuff.
Oh, no, nothing like that. Definitely not that potent.
Nothing that potent, and nothing set up like that, where like an evil object is what's controlling everybody.
They barely even have cursed items in 5e. Yeah. I know there is one cursed item in Icewind Dale. And
yeah,
it's not really that debilitating, but it does exist. Players can get it and will get it. But it doesn't really affect things too terribly much.
No. The last encounter in this book is called Cell. I won't read this one through, but essentially there's a Medusa in there.
Oh shit. At level 1 or 2. That's a problem.
Or 3. Yeah. It doesn't matter. They decided to throw a Medusa at you at the final encounter after you defeat the items and all the bad guys.
After you kill OB Sturge.
After you kill the OB Sturge. Yeah. The Medusa just puts a couple people to stone and then says, I'll give you a potion of flesh to stone if you free me and let me get out of here. And you know, I if I remember correctly, there's no save against that. You just look at her.
There's a save. There's always
there's a save.
There is a save, but it's, you get one, you don't, you know, like 5e, you get 2 saves to prevent it. And even then it doesn't really do much in that edition. No, you get 1 save and then you're stoned.
Yeah. And then basically if you do free her to get the potion to save your friends, she just turns you to stone.
So
that's the final encounter. So even if you do everything right, you have an impossible encounter at the very end.
Yeah,
some of your players are dying.
Very difficult encounter for sure.
Yeah. So like I said, I didn't get a chance to read through this entire thing, but like just the difference in how this module is presented with the town and the exploration of the town being the first big part. And I could get 2 or 3 weeks out of just that. Then exploring the areas around, and there's some, you know, combat encounters then, you know, there really isn't any combat encounters in the town, but like, it's just such a different feeling to the game. And like, you compare it to Waterdeep Dragon Heist, where like you meet Volo, almost immediately there's a fight that you can kind of socially get, kind of like wheeze your way through, or you could just, you know, help fight and, you know,
yep,
like, violence is the first option and best option in D&D. And
it's expected. It is part of the game.
Right. But, like, in this book and just reading some of the modules, like, I read through some of the encounters. Like, even the encounters with the orcs, you can bribe the chieftain to get through.
Sure.
And that stuff is written in there, just a sentence. There's no more details put into that. And I know plenty of what that means. But that stuff isn't included anymore. Like, I know they tried with Wild Beyond the Witchlight, but it just made everything more confusing.
Well, like, it wasn't with 5e, they don't expect players to be creative. They don't plan for that. Keep on the Borderlands, you're talking about, it has one sentence of you can potentially bribe the orc chief to get by, and that's probably the extent of it. And they don't give the DM any more details on how much or anything, because they expect the DM to be able to figure that out. In 5e, if they don't have, you can pay, 500 gold to the orc chief, a lot of newer DMs aren't going to know that they can just make this shit up. They could just wing it.
I guess. If I was getting more modules like this currently, I would be a lot happier with the product I've been getting.
Oh,
Like the keys from the Golden Vault was very good from that perspective. Like, here's what's going to happen. Here's your tiny scenario. Here's your background information. Have them figure it out from there. Yeah.
You get one book like that a year.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I really am hoping that the Vecna book blows me away. And I'm not expecting keys from the Infinite Staircase or keys from the Infinite Staircase.
Mixing things up here.
The Stairs from the Infinite Staircase, or whatever the book is called.
Yeah.
I'm not looking forward to that one. It's an anthology book. I'm definitely going to pick it up. I like the anthology books. I'm not wanting that one real bad. But I am looking forward to the Vecna one. Like that one's supposed to be the capstone to 5e, the big adventure that other adventures have been leading up to that and dropping small hints here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I expect more than the Shattered Obelisk did, with the obelisks being in all these adventures in 5e and then just a paragraph, at the very end explaining them. I mean, but half the paragraph was Vecna's using them somehow. Ooh.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that those things actually, that book actually turns out, and that the 10 to 20 story is really, really good, because I am.
Yeah. So it starts at level 10, doesn't it?
Technically it starts at 1.
Okay.
Because there's a 1 to 3 adventure. That's the prequel. And then 10 to 20 is the actual book. The prequel's out right now.
Okay, so it's level 1 to 3 and then level 10 to 20.
I don't think the characters carry over, but, like, the information does.
I actually, the Dungeon Master Resources group, where we get all sorts of stupid fucking questions. That I saw somebody post the other day, how do you make a level 2 character? a game master, dead serious, because they wanted to start their players out at a higher level. How do you make a level 2 character?
You make it level 1 and then level it up to 2.
That's the level of what we're dealing with these days, I'm afraid. How is that person ever going to be able to run Eve of Vecna?
I thought it was Eye of Vecna.
I don't know. The eyesore of Vecna. How do you make a level 10 character? I don't know. Make level 1s and level them up to level 10. It's literally walked through in the goddamn book.
Did you watch the Vecna Eve of Ruin trailer, by the way?
I think I did a long time ago.
Okay. Well, I'm going to link it in our podcast chat if you want, so you can watch it again. Guess who is the voice actor for Vecna?
I don't know. Is it that guy that played J. Jonah Jameson in Spider-Man?
No.
Okay. Well, he's like voice acting and all sorts of shit that I never know it's him.
Wow, he has the same fucking voice and everything.
Yeah, I don't ever recognize his voice.
Well,
except when I see him look like J. Jonah Jameson. Then I'm like, hey, I know who that is.
So Vecna, the voice actor for Vecna is Neil Newborn. And right. You might know him as Asterion.
Oh, okay. That was, yeah, I know who that is, obviously.
Yeah, Baldur's Gate 3.
Yeah,
they hired him to do Vecna's voice.
Okay, I guess he get. Does he sound differently?
Oh, yeah, very differently.
All right, that's like, good.
I mean, he's a voice actor. He's not like...
Yeah. If he sounded like Astarion playing Vecna, I'd be weirded out. I'd be like,
You can hear a bit.
Is Vecna going to kill me, or is he going to sleep with me? I don't know what's happening here.
I mean, I guess if he wants to sleep with me, fuck. Oh, God, that's an artifact, too?
And, yep, that's canon now.
So, speaking of canon events... a big canon event happened late last week. Cynthia Williams, president of Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro Gaming, has resigned after 2 years.
Yay!
Her successor has not been announced, and people have reached out for comment, and no one knows why. So, the thing with Cynthia Williams retiring, everyone has their theories. There's no solid reason as to why she retired. It was a very generic, very political statement saying she's looking forward to her future ventures and she's making a ton of money as she's leaving. And too bad, so sad. We're doing great. We'll find a replacement sooner or later. So if she had given her 2 weeks, I would assume that they would have found a replacement for her already. I'm surprised that they wouldn't have done that if it was an amicable firing.
Mm-hmm.
Or amicable leaving, not firing.
Yeah, we don't know that she was fired. We don't know really anything other than she's leaving.
Everyone gets the feeling that she was let go because of just
how bad Hasbro's doing.
Yeah, but I don't... The only issue I had with her is that she didn't know gaming. But she knew the products that she did. And if you look at everything that she's done in 2 years, licensing out D&D to other places and licensing Magic out of other places, like the Lord of the Rings set, like whoever was like, she probably wasn't said,
her.
Hey,
that wasn't her. Like that, you know, that was in the works long before she was ever there.
Maybe.
No, but it definitely like, was like they had to get licenses for that, you know, a couple years in advance, probably.
Well, who knows? Like, the rest of Universes Beyond was launched under her. So you have to give her credit for the good things, but you can also give her credit for all the bad things. You know, not saying she was the person that did the OGL, but, you know.
Yeah, she probably wasn't. I don't think that any of the blame for how shitty WotC and Hasbro are doing can be placed on her. But I don't think any of all the good stuff that's come out of them over the past 2 years also can't be put on her, because the vast majority of the stuff that they release, it takes several years to come into production. So whatever ideas she might've had probably haven't even come to fruition yet. A lot of them.
So this is my guess. And this is my big, big guess. All right. My guess is that Larian Studios was like, you just fired all the people that we worked with to make Baldur's Gate 3 in December. And now you want us to do another game with you. And that's how you treat the people that we worked with. We're not working with you anymore. And of course, Larian spun it as, oh, we can't work on our properties. We're done with D&D. We made it and had it and everything was good. I'm guessing because of that fallout that happened in December, and all those people let go, and then Larian going, we're not working with you anymore. Because it seemed very front that Larian was the one telling Hasbro that we're not working with you anymore.
Yeah, they don't have to.
They don't have to. We are at the position where we don't have to. And with the way you treated your people and everything in the past couple of years, we're not going to anymore.
Yeah.
I think that spoiling of that relationship with a company like Larian, who is a part of a company that could buy out Hasbro 10 times over, is what put that final nail in that coffin. That's my guess. That's just my intuition looking at it from the outside with no evidence whatsoever.
It's an interesting hypothesis.
Because, like, you could, there's all these other, like, little things, like the Pinkertons and the OGL and just Universes Beyond. And
whether she is responsible for any of them directly, it's still, it falls under her.
Yeah, right. And that's my point. It's just all that stuff kind of went chaos. There have been a lot of good things that happened, but they've been spending a lot of money. And right now, they're not making that money back that they've been spending. And maybe they will in the next couple of years, but they've had definitely not going to reach that we're a $5 billion company in the next 5 years when they're down under like half a million right now. So,
their stocks have tanked over the past 2 years horrifically. And her being the one in charge for those couple of years, you know, everything's going to fall on her shoulders. I don't think there's any one incident that puts her out of a job. I think it is most likely just she's making a lot of money doing what she's doing, and there's very little Hasbro can show for it.
I mean, so, you think if you go back to just like mid 2019 and even early 2020 before COVID. I mean, when COVID hit, everything tanked. But Hasbro stock was between $100 and $120.
Hasbro stock went through the goddamn roof during COVID because everybody stayed at home and played Dungeons and Dragons.
The opposite, actually. Pre-COVID, 2019 and early 2020, they were between $100 and $120 a stock price.
All right.
COVID hit, all stocks dropped.
All stocks did initially, right. Yes.
They dropped down to $40 a share. In the peak of COVID, they got back up to 75.
Yeah, okay? which is pretty good. Yeah, they that's got better than a lot of other stocks.
They got just into 100 between 20 and 22. And then in 2022, when Cynthia got on board, they went from about 100 to currently $55.
Right, yeah. So that's what I was saying. You know,
but I don't know if that big drop is just her.
No, or if it's not. It's the market. Everything has come down. Just looking at the collector's market in general, because from 2020 to 2022, people stayed home. People started spending a lot of freaking money because they weren't going out. The collector's market went through the goddamn roof for that 2 years. Yeah. And now it's bottomed out again. And I would imagine the same thing had to do with D&D. You know, they did very well for a couple of years because of that. And now people are back to their normal routines. So they're just not making the money that they were making. And they probably never will again.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, is like the stock price doesn't dictate whether D&D is a good game or Magic's a good game.
No.
But I will say this, though. I was talking to the store owner of my local gaming store this weekend because I had that project I gave him and everything. And he, in the staff meeting, told him that, and I confirmed with him later on this, is that the new set for Magic the Gathering, Thunder Junction, made the same amount of money that the Lord of the Rings release did for their store. They didn't sell as much product, but the cost, value, and profit was the same. And Lord of the Rings is the best selling. And they've changed how draft boosters work. The cost has gone up, and the products have been reduced.
Yeah. So my local game store can't sell the shit. Nobody wants that set. Nobody like Magic, at least locally, and I know this is very specific, but locally is fucking dying.
Well, move out of Alabama. So in Charleston, it's doing great. Yeah. And they're talking about how they want to expand their role playing sections in the store as well too. And kind of getting back to the first topic I want to talk about, just like there's just so many different. They turn to me and go, "What role playing system should we get?" I'm just like, all of them. Buy two of everything, throw it on the shelf, and see what people buy, and then keep buying those books. You know,
Dungeon Crawl Classics, old school, old school essentials, Pathfinder.
We got there, Pathfinder.
That's really all you really need.
Mophidius, get some more Mophidius products in there. Like, you bought the Dune book from them.
I did. Yeah. It's a weird system that I still haven't run because I have a hard time wrapping my head around it. But
yeah. Like all the Power Rangers, Transformer, G.I. Joe system that I've been kind of interested in doing, like
those will probably sell where you're at. Yeah.
I don't think they'd sell quickly, but you know, putting them up on the shelf just to kind of take up space isn't a bad thing. And letting that be available for people to purchase. And you know,
yeah, it's weird because we are sort of in almost a golden age of role-playing games. There are so many of them that exist that are out there that are doing incredibly, incredibly well. At the same time, you're only ever seeing them online. Like you can't find these things in stores.
No, it is really weird. And like, that's like the hard rub between the two. It's like, at the end of the day, I can go to Amazon and I can grab the books and be done with it. And I could probably get it for a little bit cheaper than going to my LGS. But at the same time, there are products that aren't going on Amazon, like the collector's editions and stuff like that. And with the fact that I think there's going to be with starting with the Stairs book and in Eve of Ruin, there is a version that's supposed to be LGS only for LGSs. And I'll probably buy the book. I already have, I think, pre-ordered the book, you know, so I'm going to get the pre-order book and stuff from D&D Beyond first, because that's the better deal, yeah. You know, spend $10 more and get the D&D Beyond version and the book shipped to me. And then I buy the collectors at the store. Like, that works for me. I feel like I'm still supporting my store and I'm getting both books, you know?
Right.
So if they start coming out with special edition books, I'm okay with that, you know? Yeah, it's not a needed product, and I'm still cutting out the store because I can't get the D&D Beyond from it. But like, I guess as long as the cards, like as long as Magic the Gathering is fueling the store, and because of that, I can get on my D&D product, I'm happy. But at the end of the day, it's like, what stops them from just being like a Hasbro bitch store?
Yeah. I mean, if you don't want to be like that, you have to start expanding out into other games, start carrying, you know, BattleTech and Pathfinder and all these other different types of games that aren't specific to just Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah. And like I said, some do. Like, Pokemon's very big in this area. Dragon Ball is very big in this area. Lorcana's huge in this area now. You know, and so like,
I saw some people playing that the other day at my local game store, oddly enough.
See, I told you people played it.
Yeah, there were three of them.
I just can't take it seriously, man. I can't. Like, if I sit down to play a game of Magic, and I shuffle Fuzzy Wump, the Squirrel Commander, and I attack you with 8 Fuzzle Wump Squirrels, for all for 1/1, and they squeak while I do it, like, I'm cool with that. But when I have to play Scrooge McDuck, and attack with Tinkerbell, like, all of a sudden it just feels off and wrong.
Yeah.
Like, the only deck set from Lorcana that I felt good playing was the Bodyguard aggro set, because it used Mickey, Donald, and Goofy as the Musketeers. So they got, like, weapons and armor and shit. And, like, other attack animals in red. So, yeah. like, it felt okay, but then all of a sudden when I'm fucking fighting Pocahontas and she's singing at me, I'm like, all right, I stab Pocahontas to death with my rapier. all right, well, Ariel sings the resurrection spell. Can we not?
Yeah, I can't. I'm not going to touch that game. I don't have small children or any reason whatsoever to ever play Lorcana.
My LGS and their staff meeting too was talking about how they want to organize the Pokemon cards. because Pokemon is handled very differently. The organization's handled differently. They change it every freaking set. Like, Magic's always been the same thing. It starts with white, ends with green, goes to artifacts. It's alphabetical. Okay? But in Pokemon, like, the core set will be released by Pokedex entry. So, like, it's Bulbasaur, then Charmander, and then Squirtle, you know?
Okay.
So there's no, like, there's no the numbering doesn't matter. It's not alphabetical. It's not even by type, you know? It's just random numbers.
It's just haphazard.
It's just haphazard. And then the next set won't be by Pokemon. It will actually be by Pokemon type. So it starts with a grass, and then goes to the fire, and then goes to psychic, or something like that. And then the next set will be, okay, this is just alphabetical. So they're like, we got to figure out a way to handle organizing our Pokemon cards. And I just chirped up just to be funny. I was like, why don't you just do a folder per Pokemon? You only need 151. And then one of the store employees, not knowing that I was joking about that, turns to me, pushes up his glasses on his nose and goes, actually, there's 954 shit Pokemon.
And well, like, actually.
It's like, no, you don't. You don't do this.
Oh my god.
There's only 151. I know what you're talking about. So all you need is 151 binders and then just sort them out. It'd be fine.
Yeah, that'll be perfect. All the Charizards in that one Charizard binder. All the Squirtles in the Squirtle binder. All the Pikachus in the Pikachu.
It's just crazy. I need the LGS to continue growing. I need to continue doing the best it possibly can be. And
always. Yeah. You always want your LGS to be doing well.
Yeah. I have a couple more things to talk about, and I think we've reached our hour.
Yeah, we're over an hour.
And we still didn't talk about the Elder Brain Tarrasque.
No, we're not. We don't talk about that on here.
We don't talk about the Elder Brain Tarrasque. No. Whenever we talk about it, we're out of ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a couple of topics, but they'll wait. They can definitely wait. We actually did a full hour. A lot. We did like 30 minutes on Keep of the Borderlands.
I'm proud of myself, guys. The podcast boy, the boy with podcast topics, has struck again and saved the day. Say bye, Bruce.
Bye.